Well, we're going to start out this morning, and I'm going to read a few verses. And I want you to listen for a common thread in the verses here. They're not too long. So here we go. This is Zechariah 1:1. It says, "In the eighth month, in the second year of Darius, came the word of the Lord unto Zechariah." Here's Jeremiah verses 1, chapter 1, verse 1 and 2. "The words of Jeremiah, the son of Hilkiah, to whom the word of the Lord came in the days of Josiah, the son of Amon, king of Judah, in the 13th year of his reign." And now Luke chapter 3, verses 1 and 2. "Now, in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, Pontius Pilate being governor of Judea, and Herod being tetrarch of Galilee, and his brother Philip, tetrarch of Iturea, and in the region of Trachonius, and Licinius, the tetrarch of Abilene, Annas and Caiaphas being high priests, the word of the Lord came to John, the son of Zacharias, in the wilderness." Did you notice anything as I read those?
In the year of the Lord?
The word came to.
The word came to. That's one common thing, yeah. In all three.
Dates.
Dates. Yes. Timeline. Mm-hmm. It's obvious as we look through history, as we look through scripture, that God, one of the primary ways that he works in our world is through a timeline. So back through the verses here, it says, "In the eighth month, in the second year, in the 15th year, in the days of, in the reign of certain people, certain situations." So there's a season and there's a time, and all kinds of things can happen at just the appointed time. And as we know, they don't always happen in our timeline, but when it does happen, we recognize that God is truly the grand weaver and great designer of our lives, which is what we talked about last week. So this week is the second half of last week's sermon. And we'll tie in last week here in just a minute. So it's in times that we live in right now, when all around the world, no matter where you look, no matter if you're looking at governmental leaders or church leaders, business leaders, financial leaders, there are very few of them who are sitting around and honestly saying, all is well. Rather, the refrain seems to be uncertainty everywhere. That's the common expression that someone, no matter where you look in the world today, there is uncertainty. Now, perhaps that statement doesn't really move you too much, which is fine. You know, the news of the world scene, the news of politics, the news of culture, and how things are deteriorating in those areas around the world, that might not be as important to you as other life issues, such as decisions about education, or jobs, or careers, or relationships, or money, or marriage. Now, I'm not just speaking maybe to the younger part of us in the room here with that idea, but it's true. We all have our interests that concern us. We all have our ways of being worried about this and that and the other thing, if you want to put it that way. And some of it has to do with the time of life that we're in, some of, you know, the season that we're in. When you're younger, these are the things that are on your mind. You're in school, or you're thinking of a career, or you're thinking of marriage, or you're thinking of your future for certain. Those of us that have lived a little bit longer and we've kind of dealt with those issues. I'm not going back to college, so I don't have to worry about that. I'm married, and so I don't have to worry about that anymore or whatever. So we have different interests that involve our energy and our time. But regardless of where you fit into the season or timeline right now, we are all living in a situation locally and worldwide where, as Christians, if we are really honest, we have to admit that there are a great many reasons for us to be needful of God. That's no surprise. We know that we need God, but we need him personally. But when we look at the world, we get even more of a feel of how much we ourselves need God and how much the world needs God. Now, what I just said there about us, it's said in a self-centered way, but it's a good thing. We need to think of ourselves and we need to think of how much we need God. So it's okay to say that. I need God. It's okay to be self-centered, if I can say it that way, in that way. I have a life and I need God in it. But let's think now of our neighbor. Okay, the neighbor that's love your neighbor as yourself neighbor. Neighbor in the broadest sense of the term. There are two worldviews that exist at the same time that we're facing right now. One worldview is, can be summed up by saying, I need God. The other worldview that exists in your neighbor is one that says, need God? What if I don't? One says, I need God. The other one says, what if I don't need God? I'm fine without him. And those are the two competing worldviews. So this stance, what if I don't need God? This stance or this position or this worldview or this state of the heart, it truly, I believe, characterizes the time that we're living in throughout the whole world. And it's always been that way. We understand that. But it just seems as we look at world events, as we look at what's going on in our own community, even from the newspaper or whatever, it's just is very clear. The world needs God. We talked about that a little bit last week. But so it's in the world, this position is, and yes, it's in the church because it's in my heart and it's in your heart. What did the hymn writer say? They said, prone to wander. Right? Prone to wander. Prone to leave the God that I love. Sometimes in ways that we don't recognize clearly, we too say a little bit, what if I don't need God? I can do this on my own. Well, last thing about this statement of what if, love God, what if I don't? It's a good thing because here's what it does. It has a purpose. Why it's a good thing. It displays in the headlines of our world that there is a standard set up as an absolute terror from which Christians are to run away from. If there's any thing in your heart that says, I don't need God, then you need to turn and run away from that. Because all we need to do is look out into the world and look at the results and look at the consequences of lives that have chosen to say, I don't need God. And when we see those consequences occurring, we should know to run in the opposite direction as fast as we can. Because we need him. And we need to be able to show the world that they need him too. So this will all make sense in a moment here. The timeline that we talked about. You are right here, let's say. I mean, this is eternity that way. And this is eternity this way. And somewhere, I don't know where, that's you. You're right here in God's timeline. All the rest of us, we're right here. All right? And all of us are going to live and die in that timeline right there. Sorry about that. But somewhere we fit into God's timeline. As individuals, and as a group, as a whole world, somewhere in here we live and we die in that timeline. And the headlines of this timeline, again, we said, are marked out by the results and consequences of a human heart which says, I don't need God. I can do this on my own. So during this timeline, right here, this bracketed area, we as believers need to ask God some questions. We're wondering, okay, this is what's going on. The world seems to be in a mess. My life has a lot of questions. So we ask God, well, what is God going to do in this timeline? How is his intervention going to take place? Is God going to fix this? What is it going to take? What is it going to take to restore the knowledge of God in this time? So the short answer is what it has always been. There's no different answer from this timeline to this timeline. There's no different answer in the entire timeline. The answer is God's workmen will be put to work. So this is where I bring in last week's talk, because we talked about the workmen of God. Remember, it was Charles Wesley that said, God buries his workmen. So we'll say we're going this way. So all these workmen have been buried, and right now he has a group of new workmen. And they're going to be buried. And then here, you'll have another group of workmen. But we're concerned right here, because that's where we find ourselves, right here in the moment. So what's God's answer to all of the problems in the world? Well, God's going to put his workmen to work. Paul said in his time, wherever that was, he said, I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, for the Jew first and also to the Greek. Paul was God's workman, and he had that as his theme. So we too have a similar thing. So let's recall and tie in this thought of a timeline, this thought of these questions. What is God going to do? How is his intervention going to take place? What is it going to take? Let's tie in those questions to last week's points. So here was last week in a nutshell. God also is a workman, and he has a plan. And he has a continuous work that involves you and I working with him in his design plan. So again, it's a continuous work. It's the work of, truly, we saw last week, it's the work of salvation of mankind and bringing glory to him through it all. So in God's blueprint, this is the second thing from last week. He has a blueprint, and therefore, and it's the only blueprint, and he's the only one who understands how you and I uniquely fit into that blueprint. And so he has individually created each one of us to satisfy various distinctive purposes and roles in his design. So each one of us have a unique design by God to fit in to what he's doing and what his work is. The third thing was that we saw, therefore, that God is this grand weaver of our lives. And the threads that he uses to pull his design together are our lives and how we interact with others. So we are like the threads of God, and he's creating this giant tapestry. So he's the grand weaver. And fourth thing, the work is always going to glorify him, but will inevitably require that our lives touch other lives, especially those hurting and in need. So he's getting all the glory, but he requires, though, that our lives interact with other lives, those hurting and people in need. And then finally, the important goal of these life-to-life encounters was that the saving and delivering power of the gospel is known. So that was the focus, not just to go touch somebody and help them out, but that through that contact, eventually God is glorified through the salvation of individuals. So we're bringing all those ideas into this week, and we're going to call this week's talk Priorities of God's Workmen. And when we say workmen, you understand that we're talking about a work person. It's a man, it's a woman, it's a child, it's a young adult. It's a person, God's people. And so we all live in a world that does not yet believe that they need God. And if God's way of solving this problem is to put men and women and young adults and children into the workplace, then there has to be a pathway to employment, if you will. There has to be priorities that the workman of God understands and puts into action. And so that's what we're looking at this morning. What are these priorities? Before we get to the first one, though, there might be something that you're thinking of. You're probably thinking of, yeah, workman of God, and he's going to put me to work, but what can I do? I'm just one individual. I'm just one person. And you're talking the whole world, and I'm just one person. The work is so big. So this is a very legitimate concern. And so we need to address that concern of what can one person do? Because it's really kind of a complaint. If we dig into it a little bit, it's kind of one of these excuses that Moses gave that we saw that were as we go through Moses. God says, I've got this big work for you to do. And you're sitting there going, yeah, but it's such big work and I'm just one person. What can I do? So it's really an excuse. So we need to address that. Richard Sumi is the author's name. He has a book called Nehemiah, God's Builder. And he says this on this issue. He says, it would be no surprise if a study of secret causes were undertaken to find that every golden era in human history proceeds from the devotion and righteous passion of some single individual. This does not set aside the sovereignty of God, but merely indicates the instrument in which he uniformly works. There, in one sense, is really no bona fide mass movements. It may look that way, but at the center of the column, there is always a person who knows his God, his or her God, and knows where God is going. The devotion and righteous passion from some single individual. This does not set aside the sovereignty of God, but merely indicates the instrument in which he uniformly works. Here's an example. We've already read this. I'll read it again. I stumbled through the names here. Now in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, Pontius Pilate being governor of Judea, and Herod the tetrarch of Galilee, and his brother Philip, tetrarch of Iturea, and of the region of Trachonius, and Lysanias, tetrarch of Abilene, Annas and Caiaphas being the high priest, the word of the Lord came to John in the wilderness. So here we have the seven who's who's on the world scene. Notice it's a timeline. These men were in power, not different men, but at a certain time, at a certain place, the word of God came to one person wearing funny clothes and eating funny food, you know, to proclaim a message. And God makes him to be the one to introduce the Lamb of God to the world through the righteous devotion of one person. So God raises up a voice somewhere, at some time, in some place, and changes the course of history. So remember the question, what will it take? Well, the answer is always going to be, we're just one person away from a solution that comes down from God. We're just one person away. In the eighth month, in the second year of Darius, came the word of the Lord unto Zechariah. Not the seventh month, not the third year, and not to some other king, but the eighth, the second, and to Darius. So God is, this is an example of the grand weaver. He's getting everything going. He's working at all times. He's arranging events. Details are being assembled. People are being positioned. Mind and hearts are being shaped, all in preparation for the hand of the Lord to move and the word of the Lord to be received. Name any name throughout history that you want, in or out of the Bible. So I just threw together a list of names here. David, Paul, Luther, Lincoln, Whitfield, Spurgeon, Edwards, Bonhoeffer, Graham. Without any exception, you will find that the circumstances of timing that made their story possible could not have been more perfectly arranged. It was perfect. When we say God is in control, it's true. He is in control of everything here, everything there. So here's another story about this. Does the name Harold Tannehill ring a bell for anyone? I didn't think so. I just picked it out of nowhere. No. Mr. Tannehill was a real person. He was an evangelist, a good evangelist, and he had a strong ministry to people in prison. So he visited prisons. He loved to visit prisons. He also loved to speak at Bible camps in the summer. So one day, in the timeline, this elderly gentleman sat down with a few minutes, and he sat there on a bench with a four-year-old little girl, and he told her the message of Christ. And through that talk, God drew that little girl to himself, and history was forever changed. Do you know what that little girl's name was? Nancy Jo Smith, my wife. So, why do I get a little choked up when I think of this? And I didn't warn you. You know, we went from big history to just a little history book right there. But history has never been the issue. The size of history has never been the issue. What is the issue is the devotion and righteous passion from one single individual. So what can one person do? What is it going to take? Well, how about another list of individuals? That's what I read off before. We said the Pauls and the Luthers and the Bonhoeffers. Well, how about this list? Got to get this right here. Beaver, Briley, Campbell, Chesser. Got you guys in there. Garbett, Lawrence, Nelson, Northrop, Phillips, Sample, Schmidt, Smith, Van Reesen, Williams, Winch. No, Wunsch. Wunsch. Sorry, I'm sorry. So here's one of the biggest mistakes that we can make is that we like to believe that God can't do very much with our lives. So you can't believe that. And the problem there is thinking that we're supposed to, you know, that we think it's too big, therefore I do nothing. There's nothing too small for God. It's not the size of the history. It's the size of your heart and your devotion and your love for Christ that really matters. I think maybe I've made this point, but there's one more story I got to tell because I just really like the story. So years ago, Tori Johnson. Tori was the founder of Youth for Christ back in the 30s. I believe that was 30s and 40s. But Tori was invited to go speak at a high school, but he wasn't able to go to the high school to speak. He had other appointments. So he called a young evangelist named Billy Graham and asked Billy to go. Well, Billy agreed and said, sure, I'll go do that. And so Tori told the high school that, hey, I can't come, but I have a young guy. His name is Billy Graham, and he's going to take my place. And the school said, we don't know who he is. And you know, we don't want him. We don't know who he is. And Tori said, no, you don't understand. He's good. He's a young evangelist. You won't regret it. And the school said, no, if you can't come, we're just going to cancel the event. And Tori said, have him. Have him come. And so it happened. And so Billy Graham went, and he gave the gospel message. And afterwards, Tori called Billy and asked Billy how to go. And Billy said, not very well, Tori. One person did respond to the gospel message that I gave. And Tori said, did you write his name down so you can pray for him? And Billy said, yeah, his name is Warren Wiersbe. So imagine this whole thing. An ordinary person who was unknown at the time. Now, I know he is not that anymore. But at the time, he was unknown. People did not know who he was. Billy Graham. And he became an unwanted replacement, but he had a gospel message. He had a devotion to the Lord. And one person responds. So some of you might not know who Warren Wiersbe was. I don't know if he's still alive. But he just later on became the pastor of Moody Church. And quite literally, he became one of the greatest Bible expositors in recent memory. So one person, unknown. A high school student, unknown. God puts them together in a timeline. And history has changed. If not just for those two people, but we never know what God is going to do. We cannot, it is not possible because it's not true that God cannot do very much with any one of us. It's not up to us to decide the amount. It's just up to us to decide our devotion and trust of the Lord. So, don't underestimate what God can do through you. I believe it was in reading and looking at this, just throwing this, it was a servant girl who led Charles Wesley to the Lord. It wasn't Susanna. It was one of the girls that helped in their house. She led Charles to the Lord, and history was changed because of that man. So, we as individuals, we are uniquely created, and we are appointed for moments in time, just like we've been talking about. He can use you, maybe with a statement, or maybe with a word, or maybe with a story, or maybe with a gift. Yes, there are heroes that we read about in history, but there are the unsung heroes. God's workmen, equally created, equally fashioned as the big guys. And only heaven will reveal how God has used them in his grand design. You and I are those uniquely created people appointed for moments in time. So what is the pathway? So we've answered that question. What can one person do? We've answered that concern. But what is the pathway to becoming, I got to move on here. What is the pathway to becoming that person that God will use? Well, it starts with priorities. And there was a man 400 years before Christ who gives us our example that we're going to just talk about. His name was Nehemiah. So I'm going to go to Nehemiah chapter 1, and I'm going to read verses 1 through 4, just to kind of get the context of where we're at in this story. So Nehemiah, I'll get it. Gives everybody a chance to find their spot. So I'll just go ahead and begin.
What is it?
Nehemiah chapter 1. And we're going to just go through 1 through 4. And it came to pass in the month of Chislev, in the 20th year, that I was in Shushan, the citadel, and Hanani, one of my brethren, and the commentators, they believe this is truly his brother, came to me from Judah, and I asked him concerning the Jews who had escaped and who had survived the captivity, and concerning Jerusalem. And he said to me, the survivors who are left from the captivity are in the providence are in great distress and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem is also broken down, and its gates are burned with fire. So it was, when I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for many days, and I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven. And then he goes through this wonderful prayer through the rest of the chapter. And now I'm going to skip over into chapter 2 and read a little bit there. And it came to pass in the month of Nisan, now that's 4 months later, his brother came to him 4 months prior, and Nehemiah asked about how things were going in Jerusalem, and he got the bad news, and it was horrible, and he didn't like it. And he went to prayer and fasting. And now it's 4 months later, in the 20th year of the reign of Artaxerxes, when wine was before him, that I took the wine and gave it to the king. So he was the cupbearer of the king. He was in a position of tremendous trust with the king. And imagine, the king had overtaken Nehemiah and his people. And now here's Nehemiah, the most trusted person in the whole kingdom, because Nehemiah tasted the food and drank the wine before the king did, so as to protect the king from anyone that would want to harm him. So, anyway, I took the wine and I gave it to the king. Now I had never been sad in his presence before. Therefore the king said to me, why is your face sad, since you are not sick? This is nothing but sorrow of heart. So I became dreadfully afraid, and I said to the king, may the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city and the place of my father's tombs lies waste, and its gates are burned with fire? So the king said to me, what do you request? So I prayed to the God of heaven, and I said to the king, if it pleases the king, if your servant has found favor in your sight, I ask that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it. Then the king said to me, with the queen sitting also beside him, how long will your journey be, and when will you return? So it pleased the king to send me, and I set a time for him. So that's, and the whole rest of the book is the description of how Nehemiah went and rebuilt the walls and restored the people to faith and trust in God. So when Nehemiah first heard these words from his brother, to Nehemiah, the walls of Jerusalem stood as a symbol of the presence and glory of God and of the trust that God had given the people in the protection of the city and of the temple. But the people had drifted. And you know what they did? They kind of thought for a while that they didn't need God. And then the ruin was the result of that mindset that settled in. But there's a significant word in verse 4 of chapter 1, if you turn back to that, that gives us an understanding how God was at work. And it's the word heard. In verse 4 it says, and so it was when I heard these words. So this Hebrew word, it means to hear intelligently. It means to hear with discernment and consideration. That means he heard this and he thought deeply about what it was that he just heard. One commentator says this, that when Nehemiah heard these words, he was given a pathos for his people. A pathos is a quality. It's a quality that makes a person feel pity and sadness or sorrow for those hurting and in need, the very people that we're talking about around the world that we live in. So he was he felt sorrow, he felt pity, he felt grief for the people. He just didn't say, "Oh, wow, that's really too bad. Man, those guys blew it over there." You know, he felt the emotions that they felt. So this is what motivated him. And so I'm saying the first priority of a workman of God is it's a funny word, we never use it, right? But it's a pathos for people. You could, if you want, we're going to use all P's this morning, but if you want, you could put a passion for people. It's kind of the same thing. But a pathos for people, that is the first priority for the workman of God. So the next time you hear news or you see people who are hurting, look inside of you to see what you're discerning in your heart. What effect is it having on you anymore to see what you see in the newspaper and hear what you hear in the news? Does it have an effect? Well, for Nehemiah, it did have an effect. And from this time forward, he realized that he had a responsibility, that there was a role to play. There was a thread to weave for him in the ending of the distress and the reproach of people. So Nehemiah had a pathos for people, the first priority of God's workmen. And so this whole idea brings up another important issue for our times. We as believers have to be so careful in the time in which we live. I keep bringing up the news and all this kind of thing. That's where we get our information. But the next time when we watch the news or we read the Casper newspaper or whatever it is you read, you're going to come across very different worldviews and beliefs from your own. And no matter how much we may disagree with them, and for whatever reason we dislike them, we have to learn what it means to love them. When we were given a new nature and the Holy Spirit took up residence within us, the command to love also came with him. And it's not easy to love the people that we're watching do all these horrible things, or whose lifestyle is so very different from ours, and we just think, you know, if they could just get themselves straightened out, but they won't, and so it's their fault, and we start going down that road. That is not the response that's going to win anybody to the Lord. We can't carry the gospel with that type of attitude. So this command to love, it's not easy, but whatever made us think that it was supposed to be easy in the first place. You know, it says that, Paul says that he had to learn contentment. I can learn to be, I'm satisfied with wealth and riches and fullness, and I can be, I'm satisfied with nothing. He learned contentment, and we too have to learn love. It doesn't come natural, but we have to do it. It's hard. One writer says, the problem with Christianity is not that it has been tried and found wanting, but it has been found difficult and left untried. So let me read that again. The problem with Christianity is not that it has been found tried, is not that it has been tried and found wanting, but it has been found difficult and left untried. Well, Nehemiah knew that the road ahead was difficult and that the people were going to be hard to deal with, but he had a pathos for them. He felt sorrow for them, and this is what got him up and working. So here's something that you might be thinking of at this point. There are a lot of problems out there. First, we dealt with, you know, I'm just one person, I can't do anything. Well, that's not true. Then we have this idea, well, there's so many problems, where does a person begin? You know, I can't address all these problems. I can't carry the burden of the world on my shoulders. Well, that's true, and that's a legitimate concern. So let's tackle that one for just a second so we can get beyond that excuse, because that's ultimately what it turns out to be. So there, many years ago, there was a terrible crime in New York City, and I didn't even really understand what the details of it were, other than just what this story says. But there was this terrible crime in New York City, and it involved just one family, a father, a mother, and children. And it was so alarming, it was so horrific, that it made the headlines even in that city, so large and so full and used to crime. But everybody was talking about it. The whole nation seemed to be aware of what happened to this one family in New York. At that time, the U.S. Senator of New York was Daniel Patrick Moynihan. I remember, as a young person, remembering that name all the time. And so this story really interested me, but... So anyway, he was the U.S. Senator in New York, and he came to the city council after this crime was revealed, and he raised this question to the council. He said, how could so much go so wrong in a person's life? How could so much go so wrong in a person's life over such a long period of time and no one knew about it? And he asked that to the city council in New York. And so there was this long moment of silence in the chamber, in the chambers there. And then finally, one council member stood up and he said, "Senator Moynihan, I will answer your question." He said, "I am a councilman in one of our districts." He said, "I do not have a heart big enough to bear all the burdens and sorrows, sometimes of even my own family. And you are asking me why I'm not bearing the struggles of my whole community?" And this is what he said. He said, "Sir, if you want me to bear the heartbeat and the heartache of every person here, you might as well ask me to listen to the heartbeat of every squirrel and the sound of every blade of grass growing. The noise would be deafening on the other side of silence." You see, it is true that the problems are too big. It is true that they're too many. It is true that we cannot bear them all. No person can. And no person can bear, you know, the issues of this community. No person can bear sometimes the issues in their own family. Sometimes they can't even bear the issues in their own heartache. But there's one place where the whole aggregate of human suffering was collected, and we know this. It was at the cross. It was there that the Son of God bore the burdens and heartache of the entire world. And as the master builder, the Father takes all of those heartaches. Now listen to this. He takes all of the heartaches and all of the struggles of all of the world, and he breaks them down into bearable portions. And he puts some of it into your heart, some of it into your heart, and some of it into my heart. And he makes those bearable burdens into individualized capacities. Remember, we are individuals created with a capacity. And God says, "I know exactly how much you can hold. And I have a burden that I want you to hold. And this is it. It's not too hard. We never said it was going to be easy, but it's not too hard. You can do this. He made you. He knows what you can bear." So we hear of so many needs, and we use that as our excuse not to get involved. What can one person do? What can one little act do? What can one peanut butter and jelly sandwich do with a tract inside a plastic bag? What can that do? Well, we've seen that it could maybe change history. Right? So we hear of so many needs, but we also have to realize that we stand accountable for God, before God. We have to understand, we have to seek to understand what is the individualized need that he has given me to bear. What is the heartache that he has given me to carry before this world? Someone has said that you will never lighten anyone's load unless you feel the pressure of it in your own soul. As you go and lighten somebody else's load, the pressure that was in yours is also lightened. But we have to feel it within us at first. So all of this was a long one, but all of this goes back to a pathos for people. There are no excuses. This is what we must have. We must have a pathos for people. Okay, second priority. Nehemiah began his entire mission with the priority of prayer. And that's the second priority, a priority of prayer. 11 times in 13 chapters, Nehemiah says, "So I prayed to the God of heaven, so I prayed to the God of heaven, so I prayed to the God of heaven." His brother tells him that the walls are in ruin and the people in distress, and it says, "So I prayed to the God of heaven." The king asks Nehemiah what he can do for him, and Nehemiah says, "So I prayed to the God of heaven." You know, ultimately, we will win every major battle only on our knees. There's three things that prayer accomplishes for us. It reminds us that we are not sovereign. When we say those first two words in a lot of our prayers, when we say Heavenly Father, when we say Holy Father, when we say Almighty God, those first two words remind us that we are not able to solve all the world's problems, but you know the one who can. So it simply just establishes the fact that I'm not sovereign. I'm not supposed to be able to fix everything, but I know the one who can. Number two, that it does quickly. Prayer enables us to see our heart as God sees it. So when you are on your knees before a sovereign king, there's not much room for you to declare how much you know and how right you are about this issue or that issue. There's not much room for you to be complaining about this and that and the other thing in your life. And there's no room for showcasing of your talents. we have to be careful that we can never be too cocksure of ourselves in anything. It's an old word there, but our confidence is only because of what God has put into us. If we're special, it's because God has made us special. And we have to always be reminded of this. We cannot ever become overconfident. And that's what prayer helps us remember, that He is the sovereign of the universe, not we ourselves. We are brought, our limitations are brought into focus when we're in prayer. So the true relationship of a creator and a creation is reestablished. And this is a very good thing. True humility occurs when we're on our knees. Third thing that it does is that God uses that time in prayer, and that's where He weaves into your life the characteristics and the threads of your life, so He makes you into what He's intended you to be. It's through prayer that He pulls together the threads of your life. Ravi Zacharias says this. He says, "The day you believe that your prayer life is the most critical aspect of who you are spiritually, your life will be dramatically changed." The day you believe that your prayer life is the most critical aspect of who you are spiritually, your life will be dramatically changed. So, it's only in prayer that the freedom of needing Him can grow. Needing Him only. That's where true freedom is when we find Him only. We sang the song of where I said I wish there was like 20 or 30 more verses in it that we could... what was that song? I'd rather have Jesus than anything. It's in prayer that we learn that that is a true statement and a real desire of our hearts. Another thing about prayer here, Robert Browning, he's a poet. He wrote this funny little poem. He says, "When I see children riding a cock horse," you know, a little stick horse. He says, "When I see children riding a cock horse, I find it in my heart to embarrass them and tell them that their stick is a mock horse and that they are really carrying what they say is carrying them." If you are a praying Christian, your faith in God will carry you. But if you are not a praying Christian, you will have to carry your own faith, and you will become exhausted bearing the infinite. So the praying Christian is one who is carried by God. If you're not a praying Christian, you're carrying yourself. And yeah, the burdens of the world will quickly overwhelm you just like that, because you can't carry them. Only an infinite God can carry those burdens. So, pathos for people, a priority of prayer. Third priority is proximity to people. Nehemiah went close to the situation. Ravi Zacharias, again, he was asked one time by the Mormons to come to Salt Lake City and to speak in the temple there. And he agreed to do this. And he said, I'll agree to do this, and I'll come. And he says, I want to bring Michael Card with me as the guy that's going to do the music. And the apostles and the church agreed to that. But he goes on and he says, you know, this is one of the most difficult times of his life, because it's when he received the harshest criticism from other Christians about the fact that he was going to the Mormon temple to speak to them, to be... Ravi Zacharias is an apologist. He defends the Christian faith. He evangelizes as well, but in his main thing is he's giving a reason to believe in the Christian faith and to believe in Jesus Christ as the Son of God. So he's an apologist. And he said Christians just attacked him right and left for, why would you go to such a place as that? They're just going to try to use you for their own benefit. And say something like, you know, we have this great Christian speaker, and we too are Christians because he's here, and we're all the same. We all believe the same thing. That was kind of the argument. But Robbie made sure it didn't go that way. But nevertheless, he was criticized for going there. And he would just say, what is wrong with you people? Don't you know that we have to go where there's a counter perspective? Don't you know that we have to take the gospel to places that disagree with us? He says, do you think I like doing this? I don't like doing this. I don't want to do this, but this is what God has called me to do. We have to go where we're not accepted. Chuck Colson called him during this time, and he says, you make sure you go, because people were telling him you shouldn't go. And Chuck said, called him and said, you go. But then Chuck says, you be ready, though, because it's going to be a long, cold winter afterwards. You know, people are going to keep coming at him and keep criticizing. And then again, once again, Colson said to him, you know, what are they thinking? You're an apologist. You have to go to places, like I've already said, that have a counter perspective. You have to go where people disagree with you. You have to go. You have to go. So there's that. We have to go to where we're called. We can't stay in our house. We can't stay in our church. We have to go and get in proximity with the people. So Zacharias has this aspect that he's an apologist, so he goes there. Other people meet needs in different ways, and this story will illustrate that. There's a grave marker on the island of Molokai in Hawaii. It says on it, Joseph Damien. But Joseph Damien is not buried there. Do you guys know this? Have you seen the grave? Awesome. So here's how the story goes. And I've been to Molokai before I was a believer, and I never knew this happened. But if I ever get back there, next time we go to Hawaii, dear.
Right, yeah.
We're going to go see this. So Joseph Damien was a Belgian man. And his brother, and I don't have his name, was first going to go to Molokai. And circumstances and illness and things happened to where his brother couldn't go. So Joseph went in his place. Well, what was on Molokai were lepers. In all of the Hawaiian islands, anybody that had leprosy, they were sent to Molokai, to just a village, a place there. And that's where the lepers were. And Joseph Damien went to those people. And he spent years there caring for them, loving them, ministering to them, sharing the gospel with them. He tried to find a cure for leprosy. And so he spent all this time with them, you know, in proximity to the people that God had put on his heart. Then one day, there was a kettle of boiling water, and it spilled onto his bare foot. And it took a second for him to realize it, but he realized he didn't feel any pain. And so he took some more water, and he intentionally poured it on his foot. No pain. And so that morning, as he brang devotions to the village, as he regularly did, he always addressed the people, my fellow believers. But that morning, he said, my fellow lepers. So he contracted leprosy, and he died. And when he died, the people, the lepers on the islands, they went to bury him, and the Belgian government said, no, we want him back. We want him back on our soil. He's a hero to us because of what he's done there, and we want him back. And there was this back and forth between the people on Molokai and the people, the Belgian government. And finally, an agreement was made. The leper colony said, can we have his right hand? Can we have his right hand? Because that was the hand that he touched us with. And so they agreed. And so they took off his right hand, sent the body to Belgium. That's where his body is. But when you go to Molokai today, and apparently when you see the gravestone there, only the hand is buried there. So the point is, no matter what you're called, if you're an evangelist to the Mormons, you got to go where the Mormons are. If you're going to be a missionary and love lepers, you got to go where the lepers are. Wherever the call is, it could be your place of work, it could be your neighborhood, your block, it could be your school, your college. We have to reach out, and we have to touch lives. We have to let them see the commitment that we have to Jesus Christ, the commitment that we have to uphold his truth. We have to speak, we have to touch, we have to share. And when the years go by, they'll remember you. They might mock you now and show that they hate you now, but they will remember you. So you three Schmidt kids, I think of your dad right here. They mock your dad from time to time. Their dad has a table at the University of Wyoming where all the students go back and forth, and it's filled with gospel material and creation material and apologetic material. It's just filled with anything, you know, full of stuff that people would need to know about Christ. And he talks to them. They're going to remember him. They might mock him now, but they'll appreciate him in the years to come. When they get to the end of their rope and they're looking for meaning and they're looking for a purpose in their lives, they're going to remember that guy back at the college center. And God will see that his ways are fulfilled. So, pathos for people, priority for prayer, proximity, priority of proximity. You got to go to where the people are. Two more, real fast here. We have to go through the process of preparation. Preparation has to be a priority if you're going to be a workman of God. You must prepare. If you want to touch others, you have to take the time to study. You have to learn. You have to prepare. You have to work hard. You have to train your mind to think and to work and to act in the context in which you will be. Wherever that is, wherever God has called you, you have to train yourself to be ready to have the wisdom of God and the words of God at the moment that it's needed. You have to prepare. You just can't go in without preparation. And of course, that preparation involves all kinds of things. But you've got to read, and you've got to study, and you've got to memorize, and you've got to bathe it all in prayer. You know, we know that Paul, he was put away for three years to be prepared. Moses was put away for 40 years in the backside of the desert. And we don't know all that the Lord went through before he had his baptism. But there was a preparation. There was a time of, if you will, inactivity away from the people that you're going to. But then during that time of not being associated with the people, you were being prepared. And when God says, it's time, go, then you went. And you went prepared and ready to. Now, I'm not saying we just prepare for the next 90 years and never go. You know, there's that whole thing. But the point is, there has to be a process of preparation in some way. God's workmen always prepare, and God always prepares his workmen. So we have to be ready. We have to be able to pay the price of study and of discipline, and we have to be armed with the truth. Ravi Zacharias says again, in relation to this thing of preparation, he says, you cannot set a tepid Christianity beside a scorching paganism. You know, we can't be lukewarm and go out there thinking we've got the answer when we're not prepared for what's going to be out there, because it is a scorching paganism out there. They are happy pagans, and they don't want their mind changed. And you'll be mocked, and you'll be laughed at, and you'll be sent home with your tail between your legs. But if you go prepared, you might have just the right word, just the right statement, just the right quote, just the right thing, because God has you prepared to stop the paganism for a moment and get them to start thinking about what you've said. So the process of preparation is so important. Last priority, this is a big one, is avoid the paralysis of pessimism. You know, people will say that it's hopeless, that it's never going to change. The problems are too big. You're just one person, and you're going to spend years doing this and years doing that, and it's... You know, they're going to give you every reason not to go, every reason not to pray, every reason not to be associated with them. It's never going to make a difference, they'll say. Well, here's a little story, and we're closing with this. Some years ago, there were two Christian students down at the University of Wyoming. Two students at the University of Wyoming, and they were in Bible study together, and they chose to pray for another student down at the university that they knew was lost. So they prayed, and they kept praying, and for 6 months they prayed. And all during that time, they watched this other student, and they were waiting for an opportunity to share the gospel with him. Well, finally, in God's timeline, the day came to share Christ. And the one person met with the lost person in the only place that the lost person would feel comfortable, and it was in a bar down there in Laramie, Wyoming. And after an hour or so of sharing Christ, they parted ways, and the lost person, the last words he said was, "No, I don't want to pray with you." So weeks passed, and avoiding the paralysis of pessimism, the two Christian students, they just continued to pray. They just continued to believe that God led us to pray for this guy. We've shared the gospel with him. We're watching. We're waiting. We don't see anything happening yet, but we're going to keep praying. We are not going to be pessimistic. But then, on November 18th, 1984, the lost person went out drinking with friends, and it was hours of debauchery. And had those two Christian guys seen this lost guy during this time, the temptation of pessimism probably would have reared its ugly head. They probably would have said, you know, we thought there was some hope here, but look at this guy. Look at what he's doing. Look at what he's chosen to do. He's turned his back on our message. But they didn't do that. They knew that God had told them, just keep praying. Well, that night on November 18th, 1984, the lost person, after hours of drinking, and really not after just hours of drinking, but after years and years of debauchery, he had come to the end of his rope. There were no answers to be found in Laramie, Wyoming for him. And so at 7:30 that night, giving the perfect picture for the pessimist to stake his claim, the perfect picture for the pessimist to say, see, I told you so. This lost person was on his knees with his head stuck in a toilet bowl. And he prayed these words, no more. My life ends here. And Jesus, your life begins. And in that instant, I was born again. So you see, no matter what you think you see in another person, you don't have the whole picture. You can't see what God sees. Do not be paralyzed by pessimism. Do not allow someone else to discourage you. If you have a word from the Lord and you believe that the gospel is true and that you believe that Jesus is the way and the truth and the life, you are one of God's workmen. You have no reason to be pessimistic. He has a timeline. He's created you to put you right here. He has appointed moments in that timeline for you to shine, as it were, for you to weave into God's tapestry that specific thing. It may change history on a large scale. Charles Wesley didn't know who he was going to be. Warren Wiersbe didn't know who he was going to be. Paul didn't know who he was going to be. None of us really can say that this is my life and this is how it is. God, in a moment, can change any one of us and anyone out there. And so, let God, as we said last week, what does a workman do? He loves God and he lets God work. So, wrapping this up, learn a pathos for people. Prioritize your work by prayer. Get into proximity with people. Always be in the process of preparation. Flee from the paralysis of pessimism. You do this and you will bring peace, the final P. You will bring peace to many people and situations. Let it be so. Amen.